Blog Talk Radio.
We'll be right back.
What's up? January 22nd, 2019, 8 o'clock on the East Coast. You're listening live to the Ant Canary Experience. I'm your host, Ant Canary. Pardon me, I've got a head cold. I caught it over the weekend. Spent all day yesterday in the bed when I wanted to get up and do some things for Martin Luther King Day. I couldn't, unfortunately, because I was too sick to do anything. And plus, it was cold as I don't know what yesterday, but that's no excuse. But it's good to be with you tonight. Tonight is a third annual show on Dr. King, where I do a little bit of talking about Dr. King, and then I'll play some clips for you. A lineup of clips I have for you tonight. I'm going to play... got a clip talking about the Voting Rights Act, income equality and redistribution of wealth. I'm going to play the entire I Have a Dream speech. I'm going to play his last speech, when he said he's been to the mountaintop. And then I'm going to play the actual radio clip or TV clip on from April 4th, 1968, when he was assassinated. Now, I say that the U.S. government killed Dr. Martin Luther King. A lot of people know this. A lot of people may not know this. When people say that he died, he didn't die. He was assassinated. America assassinated Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Bottom line, that's just a given. J. Edgar Hoover, which he was in charge of the FBI back then, he had a file on Dr. King. He lied about Dr. King. He made sure that that he was going to fail in the efforts that he did. And he was assassinated. And that's just the bottom line. Probably the reason why we don't have any people ask, why don't we have any black leaders? We don't have black leaders because if we did have black leaders, they would be assassinated. I mean, that's just point blank. This country was founded on racism, on genocide, and you would think that after all these years, this country would be a whole lot better off than what it is now, and it's not. We still have racism coming out there. Yazoo, I mean, to this very day. We just got through 8 years of a black president, which pretty much made half this country lose their fucking minds for 8 years. All they did was try to bring this man down, and they couldn't bring him down. They tried, though. They tried to bring him down. It didn't work. They raised the bar so high for this for that president that the president we have now, the bar is so fucking low that a snake could crawl up under it. I mean, it's just so low. And people want to complain about and say, you know, there's no such thing as white privilege. Oh, yes, there is. Because half the stuff that if Obama had done half the stuff that this president is doing now, he would have never made two terms. He probably would have made it through his first term. But the bar is so low, there's just white privilege all over the place. People say there's not, but we know the deal. People that have a little bit of common sense knows the deal. There's no way that he could have gotten away with half the stuff this clown is doing now. So where are we now? I do know that nobody's born racist. Being a racist is taught. You have to learn to be a racist. And for all the stuff that, you know, seen in this country. I mean, this country is pathetic. This country is sad. This country is not the greatest country in the world. I don't care what nobody say. This country is fucking pathetic. And you would think that all the huffing and puffing that we do as a country, you'd think we'd be a whole lot better than what we are, but we're not. We're not. We still judge people about their color, what they look like. The clown in the White House wants to build a wall. He told his two-cell, no, I ain't going to use that. His most of his supporters have cow shit for brains. he told these clowns right before he happened to get in it and won the thing that they were going to build. He was going to build a wall, and Mexico was going to pay for it. Mexico told him to fuck off, and now the reason why the government is shut down is because he made a promise. He can't keep the promise, so he's using America as he's holding America hostage. He's a terrorist. He's holding America hostage. And I thought at one time we don't negotiate with terrorists. That's exactly what he's doing. Him and his cabinet, his entire cabinet, fucking morons. They don't have a clue. The guys are racist. And we have the nerve to call America the greatest country in the world. Yeah, whatever. If you want to call in tonight, 563-999-3682. 563-999-3682. Or if you don't want to call and just want to sit back and listen, feel free to do so. We can just make this an educational program tonight. I have no problem with that. But we've got so much stuff going on in the news, and I'm going to play every clip that I have. We do 90 minutes now, so I've got time to get everything in, so I'm going to get everything in. If we run a little bit over, that's cool too. But I'm going to play everything that I've got planned for you tonight, but I just want to get that off my chest. And then we've got an incident now where we've got a bunch of school kids in D.C. over the weekend wanting to be little assholes. And now all of a sudden, I mean, the thing is this. They played the tape. They didn't play the whole tape. They played part of the tape. But when you see the whole entire thing, from what I get out of it, we had some black Israelites that were pretty much talking a whole lot of smack. These clowns got scared. They left. And the thing that kills me is that they're walking around in those stupid-ass hats. I'm going to tell you right now, those stupid hats don't give you superpowers. You can still get your ass kicked with them dumb hats. So you're walking around with bullseyes on your head. You're out there starting trouble. You see the black Israelites, you get scared of them, and you kind of wander away from them. If you guys are so scared of them, why don't you go walk off somewhere else? Like, get away from them. Like walk away from them. And where are the chaperones at? You know, if you're so scared of these people, why don't you just walk away and go somewhere else? You did. You saw the Native Americans. You want to get up in their face and you want to, you know, try to be a bad man. That little clown that was doing all this smirking, he should have got a foot in his ass and a fist in his mouth. And now all of a sudden they got him on TV doing interviews. Interviews for what? And I'm sure that the orange shit given that's in the White House right now are probably going to invite him all to the White House because, you know, that's what racist assholes do. You know, the whole thing is a hot mess. And then these people, you know, if Martin Luther King was alive today, these people would be hating on him like there's no tomorrow. But they like to wait until now that all of a sudden they want to, you know, say little speeches, you know, say little parts of the speeches he gave and pretend that we're so, you know, being phony as hell. Just being phony. You know, my thing is I'd rather you be honest and just be honest instead. Don't try to be phony now. I mean, just be 100. Just keep it 100. So now all of a sudden, you know, and you got that, I don't know, the vice president wanting to say, you know, compare Trump to MLK. Okay, I'm not even gonna respond to that stupidity. I mean, that's just straight up stupid. Anyway, first clip I'm gonna play is gonna talk about Selma and the Voting Rights Act. Give you some information. We'll try to start at the beginning, and then we're going to work our way with the speeches and try to fill you in on what Martin Luther King was about. And also, too, if you didn't know, and I'll just say this, and I'll go ahead and get to the clips, that Martin Luther King, and I've talked about this before in other programs, X-Men comic books, and I'm you know, if you've been in the show, if you've been listening to the show before, you know I'm a real big comic book fan. And by the way, the Black Panther movie got nominated for 7 Oscars, and people are losing their shit. I wonder why. Anyway, the X-Men comic books were based on, in so many words, based on Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. Now, in the comic books, the mutants were pretty much shunned. They were the outcasts. And Professor X was their leader. He wanted the X-Men to kind of blend in with the mainstream, with everybody else. But then on the other side of that, you had Magneto, which was based on Malcolm X. He was like, nah, we're not having it. He was like, pretty much like, we've got these powers. We need to use them. We need to, you know, check these people up. I mean, they're trying to kill us. We need to, you know, take care of them. So you had that dynamic going where you had Professor X was for the good. Magneto was for the opposite, bad, you know, whatever. And so that was based on Martin Luther King, the real Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. A lot of people didn't know that, but, you know, that's how we came up with that, you know, because, you know, the mutants, you know, if you apply that to real life, the mutants were anybody that weren't white that wanted to try to assimilate into the mainstream, and they got blocked at every turn. And then you have Malcolm X was like, nah, don't even, you know. And that would be a good topic for a show. It's like people think that it was a mistake to integrate. We probably, you know, they were saying we pretty much should have stayed separate from them and just went ahead and did our own thing. Now, there may be some merit to that, you know, because, I mean, a good example of that would be Black Wall Street. They were successful. They did, you know, they had their own thing. They did their own thing. White people got jealous, burned it down to the ground, you know. And I've talked about that on a lot of shows. But let me get back to the clip. We're going to play this clip. And this is talking about Selma and the Voting Rights Act.
Selma, this little town on the banks of the Alabama River, made it possible for all of our citizens to become participants in the democratic process.
Today, Selma, that little town along the Alabama River, casts a long shadow over the history of voting rights in America. When Alabama state troopers brutalized a peaceful protest there in March 1965, the United States Congress reacted with urgency. Over the previous decade, the civil rights movement scored key victories through legal, legislative, and direct actions. But despite that steady progress, movement leaders, as well as many in Congress, recognize that hundreds of thousands of African Americans were still denied that most basic American right, the vote.
The movement had to empower black people to change their own lives, and the way to do that, the only way to do that, was to give them the same vote that others had used throughout American history to change their lives.
The whole history of voting, of course, was one of the things that led to the enactment of civil rights legislation. Blacks were routinely denied the right to register, let alone vote. They were threatened if they came to register. Some were hung. Others were injured. Churches were burned. Homes were blown up. The whole history of the right of the black population to vote had gone on for years with very little success.
Dallas County in South Central Alabama fit the pattern of voter exclusion and intimidation. In the early 1960s, the voting age population of Dallas County was 30,000, more than half of whom were African American. However, only a few hundred black residents had successfully registered to vote. With an invitation from local black leaders, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, commonly called SCLC, led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., decided to focus its next campaign on Selma, the seat of Dallas County, in late 1964. Registering black voters would be the primary goal. On January 2, 1965, King and the SCLC arrived in Selma, and the voter registration campaign began. The local sheriff and his deputies, in favor of segregation, reacted violently, beating and arresting black citizens. Throughout January and February, the jail population continued to rise. Reports of imprisoned children and the startling fact that there were more blacks in jail than on the voter rolls raised alarms on Capitol Hill. In early February, after a congressional delegation investigated the situation in Selma, members called on Congress to pass voting rights legislation. Some introduced voting rights bills of their own. Despite congressional concerns, the tension and violence continued unabated. On February 18th, in nearby Marion, Alabama, a night march turned violent, and a young man named Jimmy Lee Jackson was shot as he tried to defend his mother from state troopers. When Jackson died from his injuries 8 days later, James Bevel, a member of the SCLC, called for a march from Selma to Montgomery to honor Jackson. Over the next week, Bevel's idea grew to encompass a broad protest against voting rights abuses. On Sunday, March 7th, some 600 individuals set off from Selma's Brown Chapel AME Church and began walking toward Montgomery. The demonstrators took a route across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, spanning the Alabama River. When they reached the opposite bank, Alabama state troopers blocked the road, refusing to let them pass.
It would be detrimental to your safety to continue this march, and I'm saying that this is an unlawful assembly. This march will not continue. Troopers here advance toward the group.
You saw these men putting on their gas masks. And behind the state troopers, a group of men, part of the sheriff posse, on horses, they came toward us, beating us with nightsticks, tramping us with horses, and releasing the tapers. Was hit in the head by a state trooper with a nightstick. My legs went from under me. I don't know how I made it back across the bridge, but apparently a group just literally took me back.
John Lewis suffered a fractured skull. Including Lewis, 17 marchers were hospitalized and roughly 100 wounded in all. That evening, network news channels broadcast footage of what came to be known as Bloody Sunday. On Monday morning, the front pages of newspapers across the country recounted the violence on the Pettus Bridge. The nation's and the world's eyes were on Selma. In Washington, mail and telegrams began to pour in, demanding congressional action on voter legislation. On Capitol Hill, members of the House took to the floor to register their horror at what had happened in Selma. The violence only amplified the need for a quick legislative solution. On March 15th, 8 days after Bloody Sunday, President Lyndon Johnson addressed a joint session of Congress, calling for passage of the Voting Rights Act.
There is no moral issue. It is wrong, deadly wrong, to deny any of your fellow Americans the right to vote in this country.
In a show of solidarity, Johnson used the cry of the movement to underline his commitment to the cause.
But really, it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
While Capitol Hill readied the legislative response to Bloody Sunday, demonstrators in Selma organized a second march. Once again, state troopers blocked their way. This time, the incident ended peacefully, and the marchers returned to Brown Chapel. For the next 2 weeks, the SCLC negotiated with federal officials, seeking an injunction to prevent the state of Alabama from interfering with the march. After a federal judge ruled in favor of the SCLC, the 54-mile march to Montgomery began on March 21st. As the marchers neared the state capitol 4 days later, their ranks had ballooned to 35,000 people. Later that day, King addressed the crowd. The Voting Rights Act was introduced on March 17th, 2 days after President Johnson spoke to the joint session. Over the next 4 months, the bill sailed through the judiciary committees of the House and Senate. The moral authority behind voting rights reform was so apparent that the bill swiftly cleared the normal legislative hurdles.
The bill that was developed by the Justice Department was ingenious. We were receptive to that bill immediately when that came up. That bill went through the committee like a hot knife through butter. We had 10 days of hearings, not 22 days. From start to finish, that bill passed the Congress in 6 months. Voting Rights Act.
By late July, the House and Senate reached agreement on the legislation, and the Voting Rights Act passed in early August by wide margins in both chambers. The final version of the legislation was sweeping. Echoing the 15th Amendment, it prohibited interference with the right to vote and barred literacy tests in elections. A section identified states where less than 50% of the voting age population had voted in the previous election and put their election laws under the supervision of the U.S. Department of Justice. The Attorney General gained the authority to appoint federal voting registrars and poll watchers and was urged to file suit in states that utilized the poll tax as a discriminatory tactic. The 1965 Voting Rights Act, which passed with broad bipartisan support, stands out as one of the signal pieces of legislation in the 20th century.
The Voting Rights Act was a turning point in my life. I felt privileged to be able to cast a vote affirmatively for it. It was the proudest vote I ever cast. And I've often cited that as the preeminent step forward for human rights in the history of our country.
Because that was voting, which is probably as basic a right as an American has. It resulted in us having serious steps taken towards abating these problems. And I think most everybody now recognizes that it, in fact, did save this country.
President Johnson came to Capitol Hill to sign the bill into law on August 6th.
The Rotunda of the Capitol is one of the great temples in the country, if not, you know, certainly a political temple in the country. You know, frescoes on the ceilings of the statues and everything, and it's a great hollow sound in there. I don't ever remember anything like, I don't know if there's been a ceremony like that before or since, but it was awe-inspiring.
Standing in the Capitol Rotunda, flanked by two statues of Abraham Lincoln, President Johnson congratulated Congress for passing the landmark legislation. Johnson then went into the president's room, where he signed the bill into law. There, he handed a pen to John Lewis. Congress continues to mark the passage of the Voting Rights Act and the legacy of the civil rights movement with the Congressional Civil Rights Pilgrimage. Since 1998, Representative John Lewis and the Faith and Politics Institute have taken members to cities and sites important to the civil rights movement. The annual pilgrimage culminates when the group marches across the Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Why is it important? For members of Congress, I think it is a reminder of the value of the right to vote. We who are representative of our districts, representative of this democracy, you can't help but feel the importance of what happened in Selma to this great country and the right to vote, how pivotal that is, a basic right that is the cornerstone of our democracy.
Selma is a place where we injected something very meaningful into our democracy. We opened up the political process. It made it possible for hundreds and thousands and millions of people to come in and be participants.
Okay. So that's the first clip. And I'll say this before I play the second clip. The right to vote is very important, because if it wasn't important, then there wouldn't be certain groups trying to take that right from certain people. For example, here in North Carolina, the Republican-led legislature wanted to pass voter ID laws so bad. It was just, I mean, it was just killing them. Well, they finally put it on the ballot. It won because, you know, back in the old days, when you go to a polling place, you just give them your name and address. They look you up on the computer, boom, boom, you know, and you were good to go. Now, you know, they were so busy trying to make sure that only certain people vote. And not only that, they've got a case now. We don't have a representative for District 9 because the Republican decided he wanted to cheat to win. And it's still in the court, and it got held up that nobody's taking that because it's an investigation. So don't ever think that, you know, take your right to vote, don't pretend that it doesn't mean anything. If it didn't mean anything, there wouldn't be so many people trying to take it away from us. And they will try anything they can think of to take it away from us. And they will come up with all kinds of lies trying to, you know, take it away from you. You know, pretending that illegal people vote, you know, all this other nonsense. Don't believe that crap. It's straight up garbage, and they know it. And they know it because they know if it wasn't so important, they wouldn't lie and cheat and steal to get what they're trying to get. So that's on the right to vote. This next clip is on income inequality, and we still have that going on to this very day. White people make more than black people. You know, men make more than women. It's all kind of stuff, and we're still dealing with the same issues from years ago. So I'll play this, and I'll be right back.
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists.
Estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor.
The promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home.
The other thing I want you to understand is this, that it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counters.
Well,
it didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power.
Yes, yes.
All labor has dignity.
Yes.
But you are doing another thing. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for
for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages. America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. And the question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will. At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check. I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to a group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. As somebody said earlier tonight, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure, high, and clean. But I want to get the language right tonight. I want to get the language so right that everybody here will cry out, yes, I'm black, I'm proud of it, I'm black and beautiful.
What is the relationship between this and the reality of the Negro masses?
Well, to leave Martin out of it for a moment. Martin's very rare, very great man. Martin's rare for two reasons. Partly because just because he is. And because he's a real Christian, and he really believes in nonviolence. He's arrived at something in himself, which permits him, allows him to do it. And he still has great moral authority in the South. He has none whatever in the North. Poor Martin has gone through God knows what kind of hell to awaken the American conscience. But Martin has reached the end of his rope. There's some things Martin can't do. Martin's only one man. Martin can't solve the nation's central problem by himself. There are lots of people, lots of black people, I mean now, who don't go to church no more and don't listen to Martin, you know, and who anyway are themselves produced by civilization, which is always glorified violence, unless the Negro had the gun. So that Martin is undercut by the performance of the country. The country is only concerned about nonviolence if it seems that I'm going to get violent. But I'm worried about nonviolence if it's some Alabama sheriff.
Jim, what do you see deep in the recesses of your own mind as the future of our nation? And I ask that question in that way because I think that the future of the Negro and the future of the nation are linked.
They're indissoluble.
Yeah. Now, what do you see? Are you essentially optimistic or pessimistic? And I really don't want to put words in your mouth because what I really want to find out is what you really believe.
Well, I'm both glad and sorry you asked me that question. I'll do my best to answer it. I can't be a pessimist because I'm alive. To be a pessimist means that you have agreed that human life is an academic matter. So I'm forced to be an optimist. I'm forced to believe that we can survive whatever we must survive. But the Negro in this country, the future of the Negro in this country is precisely as bright or as dark as the future of the country. It is entirely up to the American people and our representatives. It is entirely up to the American people whether or not they're going to face and deal with and embrace this stranger whom they maligned so long. What white people have to do is try to find out in their own hearts why it was necessary to have a nigger in the first place. Because I'm not a nigger. I'm a man. But if you think I'm a nigger, it means you need it. The question you've got to ask yourself, the white population of this country has got to ask itself, north and south, because it's one country, and for a Negro, there's no difference in the north and the south. There's just a difference in the way they castrate you. But the fact of the castration is the American fact. If I'm not the nigger here, and you invented him, you, the white people, invented him, then you've got to find out why.
Well,
and the future of the country depends on that, whether or not it's able to ask that question.
As a Negro and as an American, I can only hope that America has the strength and the capacity,
the moral strength,
to ask and answer that question in affirmative and constructive ways.
To face that question.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken.
Okay. Now, it seems strange to me, and it's real easy to look this stuff up because we walk around with computers in our pocket all day long. So, you know, you can easily find this information. It just seems strange to me that we always can find money to fight wars, but we can never find money to take care of the citizens in this country. Right now, our military budget is over 50% of what the yearly budget is in this country, for the entire country. So it's over 50%. That's more than, I mean, other countries combined. I mean, it's just crazy the money that this country puts into fighting wars against pretty much nobody. Because the next war we have is probably gonna kill everybody on the freaking planet. But we always take all this money. We always, you know, the thing that would kill me is, like, you know, they would say that our military is fighting for our freedoms, you know, overseas. You know, how do my freedoms get overseas? But they will find money. Any, you know, it's just amazing where they, you know, if they want money bad enough, they'll find it. But if they don't want money for something that's worthwhile, they'll never look for it. You know, now we've got this thing now where the government is pretty much held hostage for that's not the final number. $5 billion wall to keep certain people out of the country. $5 billion. And if you did get the money, that price would go up. But you can find money for this, but you can't find money to help people not get so sick that when they go to the hospital, they have to end up filing for bankruptcy so the house won't get taken away from, silly stuff like that. They can always find money for this other stuff, but they can't find money to take care of the people in this country that does the actual work. They can always find money to give, the top 1%, the 1%, in this country, give them tax breaks for money that they don't need, but you can't, but our middle class is slowly disappearing. Makes no sense. No sense at all. But they can find to look for certain things, but when it comes down to people, they can't do it. And that's where this inequality comes in it. And the one clip, it was exactly right. They back in the day when the West, after we got the Louisiana Purchase, we had all of the West part of the country to explore and all that kind. They were given land away. That's pretty much how this country got founded. When the settlers came here, they just took whatever they saw. They just took the land. So whenever the United States expanded westward, they were just giving land to white folk like crazy. They won't give a land to the free slaves. They would give land away to the white people. That's what it kills me whenever, you got people, this land has been in our country, has been in our family for centuries. Yeah, the land was given you, it was stolen. And it was given to your family. The family didn't earn anything. It was stolen land, they gave it to you. But, they seem to be proud when they say stuff like that. And then the majority makes the rules. So they gave them land and turned around and gave them money and turned around and gave them all this other stuff. But they didn't give black people. Still, they always hollering, we should pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. Well, hell, if you don't have any feet to put the boots on, how the hell are you going to pull up from anything? It's kind of hard to do that, but that's what they always say. That's what they always tell people. Pull yourselves up by your bootstraps. Well, that'd be kind of hard to do if you didn't have any feet to put the boots on. And this coming from people that had everything given to them. Now you want to tell me what I should do when you had everything given to you? Everything. I remember some of the shows that I did back in the day on how our brothers were treated when they came back from World War II. They were promised all this stuff to fight for America, but then when they got here, they didn't get jack. They got jacked. They got jacked. So it's real simple to sit up here and pretend that, it's nothing like that. It's nothing like that, But then, you don't tell the whole story. You had things given to you from day one. Everything was handed to you. But you want to pretend that, you went out there and you earned it. You worked for it. You didn't work for anything. Everything was, the government gave you all this stuff, while at the same time exterminating all the Native Americans, just took their land, you killed them, you took the land from them. So it's just, So there is no equality, even though they say that, you know, all men are created equal. You know, I don't know about all of that. I don't know about all of that. That part's not true. Some people, but not everybody. And so some of us are sitting here trying to get the leftovers from being lied to. You know, we're still waiting on that 40 acres and a mule. Didn't get that. There's been some talk about reparations and stuff like that. But, you know, I'll believe that when I see it. And if you hear that in the background, that's my granddaughter trying to open up the door. Even though she knows I'm trying to do something important, she wants to play. And that's part of the reason why I do what I do for my grandbabies. They need to know the truth. Because they are not going to get taught the stuff in school, unfortunately. This next clip that I'm going to play, this is the entire I Have a Dream speech that was given in Washington, D.C. This is the entire 17 minutes and 28 seconds. It's the entire speech. And it's a very important speech. And you should have heard the speech by now. Hopefully, most of you have. But if you haven't, here it is for you. This is the I Have a Dream speech by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
At this time, I have the honor to present to you the moral leader of our nation. I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, The Negro is still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. So we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summit of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But that is something that I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protests to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to a distrust of all white people. For many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is tied up with our destiny. And they have come to realize that their freedom is inextricably bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. And as we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our bodies, heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the cities. We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro's basic mobility is from a smaller ghetto to a larger one. We can never be satisfied as long as our children are stripped of their selfhood and robbed of their dignity by signs stating for whites only. We cannot be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, we are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution and staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities. Knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed, let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream. But one day, this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, and every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day. This will be the day when all of God's children be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee." Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California, but not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, and when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Okay, so that was the I have a dream speech. I got a couple more clips left to play, and then that'll be the end of the show tonight. I want to get these in real fast because they are important clips. This next clip is the what I call it. I don't know if that it's the technical name for it, but I call it. This is his very last speech. And this is his, when he said he's been to the mountaintop. I think if you look at that video, and it's on YouTube, I got all these clips from. If you look at that video, to me, it looks like, I don't know, it's just weird. It looks like to me that he knew something was going to happen. It just, maybe I'm just, you know, it just, to me, it just seemed like he knew that there was something bad was going to happen. But it's not a long clip, but I just want to play it for you, so here it is.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over that. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. So just as I say we aren't going to let any dogs or water hoses turn us around, we aren't going to let any injunction turn us around. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Now that was just so profound when you really think about it. I mean, he was just one man just trying to, fix this jacked up country. But, you know, if you talk to some of the older people, you know, people older than me, you know, grandparents, you know, that went through a lot of this stuff. I mean, it's better than it was, but I think that we still got a long way to go. We got a long way to go. And this last clip, remember, if you were around 1968, which was the year that I was born in. 1968 was a jacked up year. I mean, we had all kinds of stuff. You're talking about a tumultuous, I can't even say the word, but 1968 was really jacked up. Really, it was a hot mess. And this last clip is, this is the clip that announces that he was assassinated. He didn't die. Like I said earlier, he didn't die. The United States government kill Dr. Martin Luther King. And that's just the bottom line. But this is the actual you'll see what I'm talking about when I play it. I'll go ahead and play it.
Good evening. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, 39 years old and a Nobel Peace Prize winner, and the leader of the nonviolent civil rights movement in the United States, was assassinated in Memphis tonight. A sniper's bullet cut down Dr. King as he stood on a hotel balcony in Memphis. Within an hour, Dr. King was dead. That happened at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. The nation was shocked. President Johnson expressed horror and then postponed his trip to Hawaii until tomorrow. We're going to go to Memphis now and talk to ABC's Tom Jarrell, who is on the scene.
Here in Memphis, of course, a great deal of shock, a great deal of confusion, and a great deal of some violence. I can't say a great deal because I don't really know. I do know that police are very concerned, that the fire department is moving units around the streets, and that there is some rock throwing and some fires reported and some shooting. The full extent of at this time from this vantage point can't be assessed. Full curfew has been imposed on the streets of Memphis. Everyone except emergency vehicles are being cleared from the streets. The National Guard, which had been on duty here up until late last night, they have been recalled to duty and are being put on the streets of Memphis right away. Of course, a great deal of confusion and chaos resulting from the announcement here that Dr. King had died. It was a very great shock for something like this to happen. The shooting occurred at the Lorraine Motel. It was a favorite place for civil rights leaders and for Negro businessmen to stay here in Memphis. I believe we have some film now, Bob, if we can take a look at that. This is where the shooting occurred tonight, where Dr. King was killed. The Lorraine Motel is a favorite place for Negro leaders to stay while in Memphis. It's a very nice, new, modern motel. He was on the second floor balcony, out standing exactly where these two officers are, talking with some of his aides at the time of the shooting. The scene immediately became confused. Officers ran forward and attempted to secure the area. The shot apparently came from an apartment building directly across the street. The members of Dr. King's staff were there discussing a mass rally which was planned for tonight. They said that suddenly there was a sound that sounded faintly like a firecracker or something, and he was shot.
The musical program for tonight's mass rally.
Yeah, yeah.
And he had asked you to play a special tune.
Yes, yeah. Uh-huh.
Did he say anything after he was shot? Could you tell how seriously he was wounded?
He just said, "Oh," and it knocked him back, you know, off his feet.
After that, was anything said at all?
Nothing but "Oh," and we all and Reverend Jackson, he yelled back to Dr. King. We all hollered. Everybody hollered after the shooting, you know. I was standing kind of sideways. I really didn't have my back to where the shot came from. And when I turned all the way around, we saw the sheriff or the police up on the hill up there.
That was the musical director for Dr. King's group, Ben Branch. He was standing alongside Dr. King when the shot came that killed Dr. King. In fact, Dr. King was discussing tonight's musical program with Ben Branch at the very moment when the shot was fired. The shot, as I say, apparently came from an apartment building which had a number of floors and overlooked the motel. It was a very clear shot to the place where Dr. King was standing on the balcony discussing the situation with his aides. The police here in Memphis immediately issued a bulletin for a young white man dressed in dark clothes who dashed out of that building across the street. He dropped a Browning automatic rifle, which was fitted with a scope, on the sidewalk, and then he fled. We don't have any late information from police headquarters here in Memphis because communications channels at the moment are completely clogged with emergency calls. We don't know if anyone has been apprehended, although we understand that some suspects may be being questioned at police headquarters. So the situation here in Memphis is that a complete shock. The community is in a state of confusion at the moment. Telephone lines, except for emergency calls, are not being handled. Emergency calls only are being handled.
And the curfew, which has been reimposed, is a full curfew, everyone off the streets except emergency vehicles. And the National Guard has been called back out in an effort to maintain law and order. This is Tom Jarrell in Memphis. Now back to Bob Young in New York.
Thank you, Tom. Joining me here in New York is Peter Jennings, who's been on the road around the country, has seen some of the civil rights happenings, and has met Dr. King, and as I have. Peter, do you have any immediate thoughts about what this assassination, what the reactions may be around the country to it? I know this is highly speculative, but it's...
I suppose the first concern, Bob, that everybody has, and it's obviously the one that Governor Buford Ellington has and the people of Memphis have and the people of Harlem have, and other major Negro areas in the cities around the country, is the outbreak of violence. I was sitting with a friend of mine tonight who's been very involved in thinking and believing in civil rights, and asked what his reaction was and would there be violence. And he said no, he didn't think so, that King had created such a spirit, that this would not create a mass kind of violence like Malcolm X did.
I think it bodes some waiting. Unfortunately, in New York's Harlem, it's raining tonight. Weather has a great deal to do with violence, as I'm sure that both you and I know, both in this country, as indeed it does in some of the Latin countries, where we have both served.
Yeah, there's a great radio station in New York here. WBAI are the call letters, I think, which is essentially a Harlem-oriented radio station. And on past occasions when things have got, you know, touchy in that particular area, WBAI has done a great deal to keep the community knit together and calm down. I was trying to get them on the radio tonight and find out if they were keeping things cool.
Okay, so that was the last clip. We've got about 5 minutes left. Like I said earlier today, I've caught a very pretty good head cold over the weekend, so I'm not feeling too good. I still had to come on and do this show tonight, so I'm going to end it on time so I can take some medicine so I can go lay down and get this stuff out of my head. It sounds like I'm talking in a tunnel. You know how you get when you can't hear and your head is all clogged up. But anyway, so we've got a phone call, so I'm going to grab this phone call right quick, and then we're going to go ahead and call it a night and try to feel a little bit better by next week's show. So let me just hit the button right here. Okay. Oh, all right.
Yeah, 65 degree temperatures down here in BR.
What? It was. Yeah. I went to work this morning. I got in the car. Car said 18 degrees. The whole car was covered in frost. I mean, it was cold this morning. I mean, it was terrible. 18 degrees this morning. It was oof. Wow.
Yeah, you got to come on down south down here in the gorgeous red state of Louisiana.
But I did hear that it's going to get up into the 60s. I think either tomorrow or Thursday or some crazy.
That's going to be like a tip off and to start off a basketball game for you.
Oh yeah.
You're going to jump up and come right back down.
Yeah.
No, but you was having
down and go up. It's crazy.
Yeah, and recovered John Martin Luther King. It was good. You know, people come along at certain times for a reason, and during the time that they're in your presence, you don't know exactly all the details until long after the fact.
Yeah.
And people assume and put assumptions together and spins and what they think. But nobody really knows because you weren't there. And even if you were there, you'd only be on one side or the other.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the good that he done, and, you know, he was doing good for some. Others thought he was a pest, even black folks, you know, some cities.
Yeah.
They didn't want him in. So that's just the way things are. You have to get to the point where you accept life for what it is. You accept human beings or what human beings are and what they do. And I think if you ever come to that realization, then your journey through life can be a lot easier.
Yeah.
So anyway, I hope you feel better and take care of yourself. Don't let things get away and get out of hand.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah, it's just my grandkids had colds, and, you know, I'm always around them and always up on them. I don't know if it was from them or just the weather just got me. You know, I went to bed one night, I was feeling fine, and the next thing I know, I get up and my head is, you know, I had a headache, had that little funky feeling in the back of my throat and all that kind of stuff, and this is what it turned out to be. But, yeah, take a few more drugs, lay down, and get some rest. I should be good to go. So, yeah, I will be back next week with another topic.
Okay, then. Well, I'll let you go. I don't want to hold you.
Okay, I appreciate the call. I'll be back next week with another topic. You know, I should be feeling better by next week, so I'm not even worried about that. So before I go, let me come down to the bottom of this. Before I go, wait a minute. I'm going to have to do this way. Hold on one second. Let me do it like this. I don't know why I put it all the way down to the bottom. I got everything in alphabetical order. Okay, but before I go, let me just play this classic from Stevie Wonder in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King, and we'll end the show like that. And like I said, got the perps. I will be back next week with another topic, and until then, I will see you next week.
know we will. Because our hearts tell us.